This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. In 1944, the Intergovernment Conference at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, agreed the principles that would underpin monetary and financial policy in the Western world after the Second World War. These discussions also led to the creation of the International Monetary Fund. As we deal with the growing problems of coronavirus disinformation, harmful social media content, and data privacy, is it time now for a Bretton Woods for tech? Also, what role are UK companies playing in keeping people safe online? I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be discussing these and other issues with Jim Balsillie, the former chairman and co-CEO of BlackBerry, a Canadian technology company he took from an idea to $20 billion in sales globally. Amongst his many interests in business and public policy, he was a co-founder of the Centre for International Governance Innovation, based in Waterloo, Ontario, and has been listed in Time magazine's World's 100 Most Influential People. Alongside Jim is Adam Hildreth, the founder and CEO of Crisp, one of the foremost companies in the UK's world-leading safety tech sector. Crisp works to stop toxic, harmful, and fake online content from damaging enterprises, social platforms, and society. We'll also be hearing, as always, from our resident expert, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Jim, it's great to have you on the Infotagen podcast. And I think I remember, I was thinking actually, preparing for this, that I remember getting my first BlackBerry and thinking, and it was seemed like a kind of revolution that you could get email on your phone. And if you'd been, I was working in an advertising agency at the time, and you know, you'd be out at a client meeting and then have to go back to the office to check your emails, you know, later in the day. But now you could get, you didn't have to do that anymore because you could respond to messages as you went. And I was thinking about that because it's a great example of how, you know, innovations in technology change the way we work, change the way we live and change what we can do, which is what makes them so exciting. And I wondered if you, what your thoughts are on the way in which technology will change the way we live and work as we move out of the coronavirus lockdown.
Yeah, well, I think this is a time to dwell maybe a bit on Marshall McLuhan and his main four rules that technology enables, it amplifies, but if you're not careful, it can disable and then it can turn against. And so you found the enabling of efficiency to communicate, but then it probably transformed your communications because it was much more connected and much higher velocity of coordinating. But as we come out of this lockdown and with the data-driven economy and the ad-driven data-driven economy, we're really in a realm where it's disabling many things that are important and in other respects turning against. So you have to manage technology. It's not technology, not governance. Technology is not governance. It must be governed.
I think that's right. We on the previous podcast we were joined by Roger McNamee and we were talking about this exact point that actually when you look at other areas of technology for communication, be it radio or television or satellite broadcasting, with each innovation has come new oversight and new regulation to come with it, accepting that these companies have a terrific power, but that power should be exercised with a degree of responsibility. And it seems that technology has developed so fast in terms of, you know, internet communications and smart devices that the oversight hasn't really developed with it.
Yeah, well, yes, it's gone quick. They've also mastered gaslighting and capturing language and making people feel like it's all good and it's tech solutionism and do no evil and all of these kinds of things. But in fact, it's an incredibly difficult and challenging business approach to its use right now that's really appropriating public good and private rights. And so it's a very toxic business model and urgent need of regulation in many forms.
I think one thing in particular that has struck me during the coronavirus has been the development of technology around sort of track and trace apps. And actually, just before we started this recording, I saw that the UK government has now, it seems, abandoned their attempt to create their own app. They're now going to go back to the Google Apple app. Now, I think there are a couple of interesting things about that. One is, I think there were public concerns about governments gathering data based on where people are and what they're doing, which the UK government's preferred app was going to do. But secondly, it also slightly suggests that you can't develop these apps unless you're working with Google and Apple, that
the technology won't work unless you're prepared to work with them. And that's slightly concerning to put governments of big countries in that sort of a position.
Well, you're opening up a big question there and a big issue. I mean, first of all, I believe in technology, I believe in innovation, and I believe in capitalism, but we have to make sure that we work, that that the technology works for us, we don't work for it. And so tech can be a great force for good, both in the pandemic and after the pandemic. It's used in viral, antiviral research and vaccine. It's a tremendous tool for efficiency and effectiveness in all kinds of public health workers. And governments need very nuanced information and detailed information in this command economy we have right now during the pandemic. So it's a really important tool, technology. But I'm very concerned, obviously, not only with the misinformation that's happening in the pandemic, but also these tracing apps where we run to tech solutionism. And I'm very skeptical of them. We haven't had one case where they've really helped in any material sense around the world. We also get all kinds of false positives and false negatives. For them to be effective, you need a lot of thresholds you have to pass. Even once you say they're legal and they respect privacy, you need a large percentage of the population using them. You need rapid, ubiquitous testing. And the incidence of the disease has to be relatively rare so that you have a very pronounced response to any signal. So I don't think any of those really are met effectively, certainly not collectively. And I think it takes us off the scent of what is really effective. And, you know, and this issue of misinformation and disinformation causes far more damage than some potential of some potentially viable contact tracing app.
Absolutely. We'll come on to disinformation in a moment, but I thought for the UK government's initial plan for the app, their plan was to have an app which would gather data, would then, once you'd given that data to the government, it would hold it. And they wanted to hold it for 20 years to do further research. And I can understand why that might be attractive, but do you think sometimes there's a slight danger here? And firstly, there needs to be trust from the public, if they're giving data on that it's going to be used in ways that they won't know about, but therefore they've got to trust the government to do that responsibly. But also a slight danger that the default setting can sometimes be with some tech approaches from some tech firms, that whatever the task, gather as much data as you possibly can, even if it's more than you need, because that might be useful down the line. And I wonder whether the public are becoming slightly more wary of that sort of an approach.
Yeah, and it's a tricky issue because, as I said at the IGC, you know, data's not the new oil; it's the new plutonium. It's amazingly powerful, dangerous when it spreads, difficult to clean up, and with serious consequences when improperly used. And so, obviously, health data has tremendous public good, and we want that, but it can be repurposed and weaponized against us if it's not managed properly. So you're going at this issue of, if you're going to collect the data, the controller and processor of that data has to be akin to a fiduciary, whether it's my health data or any other kind. And it's like a doctor or your legal counsel, that they have to have your best interests at heart. And people, you have to pay very close attention to who has control of that data and how you manage it, and you put it under very strict governance. So I'm for good amounts of data for public good, but I'm also for very careful oversight, because it can be turned against us and weaponized by private actors, but also totalitarian tendencies that we've seen in governments. So it goes right on the issue of data governance and the need for a fiduciary lens for whoever controls and processes it.
I know that you've spoken about your concerns about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal, and that's become a slight concern for me as well, because the UK and the United States are negotiating on their trade deal. And my understanding is that the opening offer of the U.S. is based on the deal they've just concluded with Mexico and Canada. But one of my concerns there are, of course, the safe harbor provisions, which make it which make it difficult to create any kind of legal liability for social media companies for the content that they curate and serve, but also that deny the right of government agencies to audit or inspect the way in which data is being gathered and used and the way algorithms work. And I wonder if those were concerns that, that you shared with regards to the deal that's been done for Canada.
Well, absolutely. And I've been very public about it. We have to pay attention to, you know, what are trade deals about, both in the traditional tangible economy and in the intangible economy. In the tangible economy, really, it's about getting rid of tariffs and comparative advantage of trading and well-established concepts there. But in the intangible economy, it works on a very different set of principles, where it's about forms of remote regulatory control. And that's deeply concerning, which is the opposite of free trade. These are actually restricted structure agreements. And of course, and I served on committees in Brussels on this years ago when the Obama administration was pushing this on the EU. And you've been a real leader in articulating the concerns of things like Section 230 being foisted on the British. This is basically disabling the ability for sovereign control. You're seeing the U.S. revisiting their rules with different approaches by the Republicans and the Democrats, and rightly so. It is way too early to be enshrining data provisions into trade agreements, but it is really an effort to advance their corporate interests that are lobbied into trade negotiations, and Canada will pay a sorry price, because treaties last a long time. And you're very appropriate, and the citizens of UK are fortunate to have you pushing against it in your leadership of articulating that this is not treaty ready. These are sovereign decisions for a sovereign nation, and you push against things like 230, which are in the flux right now anyway.
Indeed, I see the first indications that the Americans may themselves plan to change it, and the American government may push for that. But going on to disinformation, one of the things we've talked about quite a lot on this podcast series is how I think having a problem with disinformation during a major public health emergency puts the problem in a slightly different context. It's not just about politics and elections. It's about the information you need to keep yourself and your family safe. And I think it's created a heightened level of awareness of that. But alongside that, and certainly in America, and probably because of the impending general election in America, we're starting to see quite a different approach being taken by the tech companies on that as well. Twitter have been intervening on Donald Trump's tweets. Facebook say they won't. YouTube last year has banned data targeting for political communications. And I'd be interested in your perspective from Canada, looking over the border at the way this debate is opening up between the different tech companies and their different approach to dealing with disinformation and harmful speech.
Yeah, well, what you're seeing is this, and this goes right back to your issue of 230, Section 230, where you've got elements of the Republican Party saying, how dare you even consider interfering in any way, shape, or form? That's disrupting free speech, which I actually don't agree with. And then you've got the Democrats saying that this is not about free speech. This is about a corporate actor applying algorithms to modify the carrying and amplification of free speech, of someone's speech. And that's actually a business decision, and you shouldn't be given broad waivers for that. So we're seeing it really very different views on this. One that says don't touch anything, and the other that says once you touch it, it's actually a business decision, not free speech, which I actually quite agree with. And they get to debate this, but it's enshrined in a trade agreement with Canada and Mexico and the new NAFTA. And this is precisely what was the battle between the EU and the US on TTIP. And rightly so, you're paying attention to it right now. So it shows that data governance is the most important public policy issue of our time. It plays dramatically with enormous public resources and public goods and private rights. And this kind of neoliberal hands-off is outright folly. And it's just a form of gaslighting so that private actors can profit or questionable totalitarian state actors can push their control of citizens. So if we want a flourishing democracy and a flourishing economy and flourishing civic values, social values, we have to make sure that this technology works for us, not against us, which, you know, links back to my McLuhan set of rules earlier in our conversation.
Absolutely. I think I remember when we met last year in Ottawa for the International Grand Committee meeting. I remember one of the points that came out quite strongly from that was this was, I think, about Twitter bots. So someone said this, that as far as they were aware, that bots don't have First Amendment rights of free speech. But I think we could extend that to sort of like algorithms as well, in that someone may say something, that's their point of view, but actually restricting someone's ability to manipulate and exploit the tools of social media to help reach help turn what they say go to a huge audience, that's not necessarily a right that they have. And the companies that have created those tools to make money for themselves shouldn't be absolved of any responsibility for being able to promote whatever they want in order to make that money.
Yes, and we have to look at how we've organized our society over years. We've banned robber barons in anti-competitive behavior. We've banned things like slavery in markets. We've put in worker rights. We've put in social welfare programs. We've put in environmental rules. So we have to make sure that the system is designed in a way that works and flourishes and serves public interest. And so right now we have this appropriation model that's degrading our values, our mental health, our democracy, our social solidarity, and it's taking away private rights. And so we absolutely have to pay much greater attention to how we ensure that these technologies are serving us, not degrading very important public fabric and public goods. And it's all couched in that's what I meant by this gaslighting and weaponizing language. It's about free speech, which it's not. It's about neoliberalism sharing information. It's quite the contrary, but it's this very clever manipulation of speech that, and then couple that with enormous lobbying amounts. And this is why we're getting this slow response to governing something that should be working for us and building a flourishing society, rather than the enormous prices we're paying right now.
Just a final question for me before I'd like to bring Adam into the conversation as well. Do you have any concerns as a kind of entrepreneur, businessman yourself, that the consolidation of tech into the hands of three or four massive companies may not be the most healthy thing in terms of allowing innovation and development to create new tools and new ideas, if ultimately the route to market for any business is ultimately in partnership with the giants? Do you have a concern that the model isn't the best?
Well, for sure. I mean, the nature of the data-driven economy is it breaks markets. It's got economies of scale. It's got economies of scope. It's got externalities to it, and it's got asymmetries, and all those together break markets, and that undermines dynamism. It undermines the equitability of distribution. It also, and it's a business model, the data-driven model, which clearly needs to ban targeted ads, because that's appropriating public good for private good for these very specific, you know, quote unquote, free services we get. And I will segue a little bit. So yes, I'm deeply concerned about this, and these are very powerful companies, and that's why I commend you for your work in establishing the International Grand Committee. And I did a keynote a couple of years ago at the IMF and called for a new Bretton Woods to deal with these intangibles economy of IP and data. And I actually think what you've done at the IGC and its recent meeting in Washington is exactly that, where we have to organize in response to this, because we're very fragmented in understanding this in different traditional silos, as well as, you know, different geographies, and so it's ripe for exploitation. And the response is an organizing principle of shared values and shared interests to ensure that we deal with the economic elements, which you talked about, the monopolistic structures and the social regulatory structures, in a coordinated basis, akin to what we did with the Financial Stability Board after the 2008 financial crisis. People, multi-stakeholders, multi-nations said, we got to get together, we got to make sure this doesn't happen again. I think we're in a very similar structure for managing the data economy for its economic and non-economic effects.
Absolutely. I mean, thank you for mentioning the International Grand Committee. And I should say as well that I think one of the best places that stores the information about the work of the committee and the hearings it's done is the organisation you support, the Centre for International Governance Innovation, which also I think is doing a great job in sort of bringing the debate together on many of these issues, certainly between the times when we try and have the meeting, the international meetings of the committee. But Adam, I'm really pleased that you could join us for this conversation today. I mean, you're chief exec of Crisp Thinking, one of the leading British companies working in the sort of safe tech space, looking to keep the user experience safe online, and working with some of the biggest companies in the world in doing that. I mean, how do you see the public demand and the demand from companies to do more to improve the user experience on online and through social media?
Hi, Damien. So I think that it's a really, really interesting debate in terms of where the platform sits. They want the best possible user experience they can deliver. But I think what we all have to remember is we've gone from a world where we had, you know, print media, I guess, where they absolutely controlled the narrative that was delivered, to a world where we as end users and every single end user actually can deliver whatever message we want, which is absolutely amazing, but also absolutely terrifying at the same time. And it's where we draw the line, and whether you almost, and who actually draws that line as well. So when we look at who's in control of that user experience, I think there needs to be government action for certain elements, you know, illegal content, issues to do with public health, election and politics. So it's not there, but I think it's a very hard line to draw. But what we certainly see is that the social platforms want to do everything they possibly can, but they also realize that they're a platform and it's for users to create that content.
And do you, I mean, in terms of certainly with social media companies, the capability, I mean, do you think the capability is there to identify harmful speech more readily, or is it still a challenging frontier?
So we think they do incredibly well at identifying illegal content. And we can always do better. And there's always what we refer to as unknown unknowns. So types of illegal content that we've not previously seen, but does fall within the law, so we know it's illegal. What's hard is when you start to move into this, what I term harmful content. So it's not illegal, but as a society, we all would see it as harmful, or the vast majority of us would. And that's when we start to get real differences between freedom of speech and what content I want to see as an end user, maybe what is different to what you want to see. So I think the capability is absolutely there when it's a very binary decision. Is it illegal or isn't it? Where it becomes really hard is working out what's harmful, and that's almost on a user-by-user basis or a group of users that's there. And I think that's the next massive step that needs to happen for the social platforms is, how do we allow freedom of expression, allow people to get their opinion across, deliver what the whole premise was behind social media, but at the same time making sure that as an end user, I'm not harmed, you're not harmed, and that's an independent choice.
I think it's interesting in the context of coronavirus on that, because we've seen, I think, companies making decisions about public health, public safety that they wouldn't have made before. So I think, you know, Facebook closing David Icke's page because he was promoting the idea that 5G was 5G mobile signals was the cause of coronavirus, and because there was an imminent, because that could lead to real harm. We'd seen arson attacks on mobile phone masks because people believed this message, and I thought that was quite interesting, because I don't think it's the kind of, I think that would have been seen as part of a free speech debate in the past. And we may see this again with regards to a vaccine for COVID as well, because there will be anti-vaccine movements, I'm sure, telling people not to take it, even though they should, to keep themselves safe. And do you think that in there, we may see the companies do more to deal with the anti-vaccine movement and people who are spreading information that actually, if followed, could lead to physical harm?
I think it's definitely a trend that we're seeing right now, which is when the end result of that online content is physical harm or significant public health issues, that people want to do good and want to make sure that can't happen. So I do think, unfortunately, that we're in, you know, COVID-19 era, there will be some positives that come out of it, in the sense of how we can all understand that the online world can affect us in the real world, and that steps will be taken. And I think a number of the platforms have absolutely, and rightly so, taken a stance against certain types of content that we know transforms into real world harms. And that's not to say, by the way, that we can't be mentally harmed by what we see online at the same time. But I think it's a big stepping stone, and I think you'll see more and more platforms. But they also need a framework that means that they're not biased on their decisions as well. And I think that's, again, a really hard one to judge. There are plenty of people that don't believe in vaccinations in the world. There are plenty of people that believe in vaccinations. But who is the sort of judge and jury there to decide what's right and what's wrong? And I think, again, what we've heard from a lot of the social platforms, they don't necessarily want to be in that judgment seat. So the question is, who does sit in that seat?
I think it is one of the most interesting questions here, because I'd certainly think my view is that there should be a sort of code, there should be guidance for the companies about what we should expect of them. And with that, the ability to have some sort of oversight. I felt that the broadcasting code we have in the UK is not an unhelpful model for that, because Parliament has created some guidelines that an independent regulator works with by developing into a code of practice. And it covers all sorts of intangible things like taste and decency and balance that Ofcom has to make decisions on based on this code. That for the broadcasters, they don't have someone standing over them pre-approving what they do. It's their responsibility to act within the code, but ultimately there's someone that can intervene and take action against them if they feel they're not just in breach, but in breach deliberately and without any desire to amend the way they work. Do you think, from your perspective on the industry, that there could be acceptance for creating a code like that with a regulator like Ofcom with certain powers in law?
I absolutely think there is scope to do that. And I think that what we saw with print media and broadcast media was, you know, we've been here before. This isn't a new challenge. You know, that's why codes of ethics were created. That's why there were principles put in place. That's why it has a regulator. I guess it still comes down to, when that framework is there, who polices it? And is it the platforms themselves that are then responsible for that content? Or is it the end user that's posting? And I think that's the challenge. When you've got a small number of journalists that can be trained on the rights and wrongs, it's very easy in comparison to having millions and billions of end users that any one of us can create content for any number of reasons. Maybe because I want to put my opinion out there, and maybe because I'm a bad actor that wants to manipulate society because I'm working for a rogue state. So I guess it all comes down to policing and how you do that. And again, when in the comparison to sort of broadcast media, journalists and producers can be trained in a lot easier way than what we can train the entire population, everyone that's got access to their handheld device. So I'd love to see a framework that's there. I just don't quite know that we're ready yet to implement something, because I'm not sure how you enforce it at scale.
Do you think this, in part, this could be done around audience levels as well, which I suppose is sort of what's happened in traditional broadcast media, that a YouTuber with a big following, or someone who's the controller of a Facebook group or page with hundreds of thousands of people following it, that there could be closer oversight of people serving online influencers, if you like, than trying to monitor what everyone is saying on social media at any one time.
And absolutely, and I think we're actually doing quite a lot of that at the moment, not CRISP ourselves, but the industry, with regards to influencers from a marketing perspective, when we're moving towards a place where they have to explain when they're being paid to say what they're being saying and what they're saying. So I actually think the industry is absolutely taking the right steps. And you're right, it's a lot easier to do this for people that are making revenue, so advertising revenue, or making another significant gain from doing that, versus going out after every single user that's there that may have posted something that 10 people saw, versus someone that was making tens of thousands in advertising revenue that has millions of fans. I also think there's a really, really important point as well that you've just made about audiences. And I think it might get to the point where as long as platforms are very open about what their rules are, what audience they're designed for, or what different parts of their platforms are designed for what types of audiences, then it becomes a lot easier. We've already got this with regards to film ratings. I can decide that I'm not going to watch an 18 that's got certain aspects in it and we know that's not suitable for kids. I'm just wondering where we are probably closer to getting to different levels of policies and different types of groups and environments within the social platform. So I, as an end user, can decide where I want to consume content from and where I don't.
Yeah. Just before I bring in Charles, just want to touch on something I talked about with Jim Borsilli, that you know, we've got a tech industry which is in some ways dominated by three or four big companies based in or headquartered in America. For you as an entrepreneur, tech entrepreneur, businessman running a British company, how easy is it for British firms to compete? And where do you think the opportunities are?
I always think it, you know, as any entrepreneur, it is very easy to compete if we've got the right solution. Now, I think luckily, the online safety tech space, the UK has had a sort of foundations here for a number of years. And what's hard about entering the online safety world is it's not just something you can pick up. You have to have been there and seen it and done it to know about all the ways of what does work and what doesn't work and how we can innovate. So I think we've certainly found it as a business, as long as we've got the right solutions, very, very easy to deal with, you know, large platforms, large customers. Most of our customer base are, you know, big Fortune 500s in North America. But I think that's only because we had the right solution.
Yeah.
And I do believe that as a sort of a nation and the foundations, as I mentioned, that online safety tech world, we seem to be very, very good at and have a number of really good vendors that are there. And actually, we're less so at actually creating the platforms themselves that attract the end users, if we look at our success there. So I think if we were going to sort of pin ourselves in one position or one place, it would definitely be around the online safety tech.
Great. Very good. Charles, you've been listening in as always.
Always.
It's good to have you with us again. And what have you been looking at in the last few days?
Thanks, Damien. Well, speaking of revenue, I've been looking at a new rumor that's floating around social media about a U.S. government plot to spread COVID-19. And what started this rumor was the issue of a new U.S. quarter. What makes this quarter special is that the front has a picture of George Washington, like the rest, but unlike most quarters, the back features a hanging mother bat and a baby bat. And they were first issued this year, which means so far, they're also all dated 2020. So you have a bat and 2020. And while they purport to be a special issue commemorating the U.S. National Park in American Samoa, the story is circulating that they're in fact a tacit admission by the U.S. government that they're involved in a plot to spread COVID-19. There are lots of theories around how COVID-19 started, but one is that it originated with people eating bats from live markets in Wuhan, China. And there's a meme out now that contains all the tropes of disinformation. The headline reads, "You decide, is this a clue or a coincidence?" And the body says that bats symbolize death and rebirth. Why are there bats on the new 2020 quarters the same year COVID-19 spreads worldwide? And finally, ubiquitous to share this post before it's banned with lots of exclamation marks. So I think this is a pretty amazing and funny meme, actually. So I've bought in. If you don't recognize that sound, it's the sound of a bag of money. Not that I'm that familiar with it. And I happen to have 100 COVID bat quarters that I've ordered straight from the U.S. Mint, which is great. But what's unfortunate for me is the coins are actually part of the America the Beautiful Quarters program, authorized by Congress in 2018, and they're celebrating 56 different national parks and so on. So I decided that instead of me being out $25, what I'd like to do is have my own attempt at spreading some disinformation. So what you need to know is that COVID actually doesn't come from bats. It was developed in a lab in DC and originally designed to be spread through the magnetic stripe in the new Barack Obama $100 bill. Now, don't laugh because they're coming. Just wait. One of the lab workers accidentally released it when he used one of the bills to buy pizzas at the Chuck E. Cheese that Hillary secretly owns with Sleepy Joe. And anyway, those COVID quarters aren't an admission of guilt. They've actually been made to block the coronavirus spreading microwaves from the $100 bill. And if you wear one in your breast pocket, you won't get COVID. Now, I just happen to have 100 of them, and I will reluctantly part with a few for a couple hundred each.
Okay, well, but we'll just, people want to email the infotagen.com site if they want to put in a bid.
There we go.
Thank you, Charles. Jim, I just wanted to come back and ask you just a follow-up question. Remember when we spoke a few weeks ago, you sort of said, I thought, a really important point, which was that there's a slight danger when we talk about technology that we focus almost exclusively on the problems because they're apparent and we're seeking solutions to them. But actually, the technology will play an important role in how we come out of this crisis. And I think we've even seen through it as playing an increasingly central role in our lives. And which direction would you steer us in looking at where the potential for technology to solve new problems?
Well, I think it has enormous potential, but it has to be planned. And I think we have to quote the acclaimed Carl Polanyi, laissez-faire was planned. And so we have an issue with the business model in data right now. It just has to be banned, this attention behavior modification. You talked about the UK Broadcasting Act. I think that's a very good lens for where the controller has some form of fiduciary responsibility to create, you know, a better public and a public resource. And then as you go into the post-pandemic, you can start to say, okay, how do we want to develop the values, the mental health, the democracy, the flourishing privacy and the flourishing society? And also, how do we want the economic dynamism, equitability of distribution, and prosperity, fair taxation, all of these kinds of things? So yeah, it's definitely possible, but you have to be deliberate in this, or there's such a pull that we've talked about earlier for to go back to the neoliberal hands-off mode. And I think if we do that, then the tensions and the issues that we had before will quickly turn against us. So this is an incredibly important time to be front-footed. I think the pandemic has really shown the role of government, and people value it. Even those that were the most neoliberal see it. And I think you seize on this window and start designing the kind of economy and the kind of society that we can flourish in for the next 100 years.
Do you think there's a slight danger when we talk about the economy that governments in particular are used to using language which were really designed for the sort of pre-technology world, or certainly not the modern economy? So when we talk about free trade and the neoliberal economy, that was a world where you made, you know, you manufactured stuff, you developed markets for it, you sought to compete on price, and that free market, you know, allowed innovation and reduction in costs and consumer benefits. But the data world and the technology world is a world of, you know, of IP and protection and people seeking to sort of, heard you talk about before, sort of, you know, hold and develop monopolies of power. And do you think we need a different set of language when we talk about tech in the public policy landscape?
Well, 100%. One, of course, it cross-cuts to public goods much more, non-economic realms than it does economic. But more importantly, or also important, as you mentioned, the comparative advantage is a cooperative framework. Everybody wins. But in tech, somebody's the landlord and somebody's the tenant, and it's not a cooperative system. So the original sin in the World Trade Organization is putting TRIPS in the IP system into what was really about getting rid of tariffs. And then what you have is these rivalrous systems. And so we need a totally new approach. And that's why there's contention between US and China on how you regulate intellectual property. The other part of data is it embeds values. So everyone wants to cooperate on free trade. Everyone wants to cooperate on banking. But how you do data governance, not everybody's on the same page. So we absolutely need a new lens on this. We absolutely need to revisit our institutions. I think the idea of the IGC and the a new kind of digital stability board is a beginning. I think we're going to have to start to look at the IP rights. Certainly, there's been about 250,000 patents filed just on AI and machine learning in the last 20 years. And so it's creating huge winners and losers. It's creating geopolitical structures. It's creating big power rivalries and mercantilist behavior. And so we're into a very bumpy era of global arrangements and global interaction. And so we really need to put on our thinking caps. We need to engage, and we need to shape the kind of world that we want to see. But there's not a clear orthodoxy right now. There's not a clear lens of thinking and institutional design. And so that's why working on the global public policy, the global governance, the kind of things you've led, it is the issue of our time. It is the root of so many of the problems we have. And we're going to need to come together. And if it's going to be a data-driven model that's based on behavior modification that profits on triggering negative emotion, then it will pull us apart for addressing very important issues like climate change or pandemics just at the time we need to come together in a democratic forum. So it is a precondition to addressing this as a precondition for really moving forward in the things that matter most to our countries and our societies and the world.
Yeah, well, I think your call earlier on for a sort of Bretton Woods for the sort of data economy and the tech economy, I think would be right, because so many of these things seems to be being negotiated bilaterally between nations, if at all, at the moment, and are going to be fundamental to the way we live and work in the future. But I think that's that sort of brings us probably to a close now, unless anyone has any final points that they would like to make. Otherwise, I'd just like to thank you all for your time and for being part of the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Damien, and thank you for your leadership.
Thank you, Jamie.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Jimbal Silly, Adam Hildreth, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.